Welcome to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast series. Open House Melbourne acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded. This podcast series explores themes or issues that act as catalysts for creative design thinking and clever design solutions. Each episode features a designer or creative in conversation with a client or field expert to unpack the topic through the lens of design and the built environment. This podcast was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. I'm your host, Tanya Davidge, and in this episode, we're looking at audience as a catalyst for design through the lens of performing arts centres. The modern performing arts centre has its roots in the 1960s. These centres were designed as iconic buildings, which spoke to their important role in our cities and our towns. Although they were founded with great intentions of bringing the arts to a wider public audience, they've traditionally showcased the high arts to a relatively narrow cross-section of the community. Contemporary arts institutions, however, aspire to reach a broader demographic and tell stories that connect with a greater cross-section of the community. Today, we're speaking with Professor Katja Johansson from Edith Cowan University and architect and founding director Ian McDougall of ARM Architecture to unpack the role of the Performing Arts Centre in contemporary society and explore the relationship of audience to design. Katja, you're an academic. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and what areas you focus on?
Yeah, thank you, Tanya. My research interest is really about the meeting of arts production and the audiences that experience. We have a variation in the ways that we react to an arts experience from, you know, boredom and disengagement and distraction to sometimes some really kind of life-changing revelatory moments. So I'm interested in the factors that contribute to that variation in the ways that we respond. And one of those variations I've discovered with my colleague Hilary Glow is the spaces and places in which you have those experiences. So that's what brought performing arts centres to our attention.
So those spaces and places can heighten your experience or also potentially detract from it. Is that correct?
Yes, they can do both depending on the design, who you are, and the extent to which the design of the building is conducive to the what you're looking for and who you are.
Oh, how interesting. And Ian, as an architect, you're very well known for your work on public buildings. I was wondering if you could share a bit of an overview of some of your key projects and contributions in the area.
Sure. Thanks, Tanya. We've been involved with public buildings for probably 35 years, but in particular, I've developed a great interest in performing arts buildings, and they range from, you know, the grand Sydney Opera House and the Concert Hall that we recently refurbished, to Hamer Hall, but down to projects like a little cultural centre in Victor Harbour in South Australia, one that's just working on at the moment at Wagga Wagga, and even projects that are kind of a little bit out of left of field, where we've been looking at the feasibility for the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl precinct. And so it's a kind of wide range of audiences and types of buildings.
Amazing. That's an incredible range and expanse of work. I did not realise that you did the Victor Harbour one. My parents lived there for a while.
Oh, right.
Next time I visit, I'll have to pop in and check it out. Katja, I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an understanding, I suppose, of the history and the role of performing arts centres in Australia.
Yes, sure. So the idea of the performing arts centre really came out of the era of reconstruction after the Second World War. So as you say, that sort of period from 1945 up until the 1960s. And this was kind of a time of real sort of national soul searching about the kinds of civic life Australians should have, and I guess what would be conducive to peace and democracy. And a lot of that thinking was around the public infrastructure that was provided. So there was a big investment in public infrastructure, and real kind of thought put into what people, you know, were seen, you know, to need. And one of those things was one of those themes was really kind of trying to equalise the extent to which people had access to arts experiences. So the idea of the Performing Arts Centre was that there should be a kind of a public place where people from, you know, who ranged across a whole community could come together and have arts experiences. I guess in hindsight, the thing about that is that the people who were advocating the performing arts centres were people who had an investment in particular kinds of performing arts and I suppose particular styles. And so while they wanted that to be experienced by everybody, it tended to reflect their tastes and preferences.
Mm. So maybe if we look back on that today, that feels a bit like a top-down model.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Good intentions, maybe. It's taken some years, I think, to work out what a model that is adaptable to the changing demographics that Australian communities have might look like.
But an incredible investment in the arts, I would imagine, nonetheless, and that would have impacted what these art centres look like and where they were placed and how many of them there were. So, Ian, I suppose from a design perspective, how did this traditionally play out in the design of our performing arts centres?
I mean, Katia raised a very good point about that fact of the sort of improver model. I mean, the improver model goes back to 19th century, early 20th century in Australia when, you know, towns built town halls and mechanics institutes and things like that, where people would go to see, the orator or the local orchestra or whatever. So there was always an improver sense to them, but the ones post-war in particular took on a sort of a model, and there's one proposition that it followed the line of the Lincoln Center, and the Lincoln Center really demolished a section of New York and built an enclave for people, for the, let's call them the richies, to drive in, park underneath, pop up, go and see a show, and then go out without having to rub shoulders with the hoi polloi. So that idea of the sort of little fort and the sort of isolated, and maybe the Opera House contributed to this, the idea of the sort of emblematic art centre that had its sort of own motif and its own sense, that idea of it being separated from the community and you went there, that's a very strong tradition that exists today. The idea of we'll make a grand statement, and certainly the politics of the funding of these has kind of carries that burden.
Mm. And that talk about a little isolated island of the arts in a sea of, you know, you're disconnected, I suppose, from the sea of anything else is kind of an interesting thought, isn't it?
Well, you get all this sort of cultural blending. On the one hand, performing artists were seen as kind of villainry, you might say. They were sort of slightly, you know, showies. And so you had to keep the community separate to that, but you're allowed to go and watch them because they did extraordinary things. Mm. So there's a little bit of that tradition, I think, too. But I think the other thing that came through in that post-war period was that there wasn't that sense, which is growing, of the community being cultural participants. And so the tradition that is within maybe non-Anglo culture or non-Anglo-American culture, but other cultures where performance is actually a cultural inclusive activity. It's a participatory activity that hasn't really grown, wasn't part of that tradition, the post-war tradition that Katia mentioned.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Could I just add to that as well? I mean, as Ian says, you know, it's a model very much, you know, the fact that this took place in that sort of post-war period in which there was a lot of public investment, you know, at the same time, cars were seen as the kind of major form of transport. And so that sort of idea that the centres are built, you know, in the middle of a large car park, you know, is kind of important in thinking about the way that, you know, what the implications of that are, because it does mean that it's very difficult to incidentally encounter those buildings because, you know, to do so you need to walk through the car park, or, you know, you only would go there if you were planning to go and to see a show. So it's very difficult for people to, you know, who are interested in what might be going on there to kind of dabble a little bit because, you know, they have to sort of have the purpose of arriving in their car. There's no kind of, they don't tend to sort of front onto the busy high street.
You can't just dip your toe in the water of a performing art or some of those older, more traditional performing arts centres.
Yeah, that are right in the middle of town, you know, like Broadway. Yeah. Or in Melbourne, in the main streets of Melbourne, there's the theatres.
And obviously we're dealing with a lot of them because they were incredible buildings, a lot of them, and so they're still in use. Mm. But what are the kind of challenges that they're being, like these, I suppose the existing ones are being faced with now?
Well, the older ones are successful because we've got a great public transport infrastructure.
Yeah.
Do you mean like the older theatres, the 19th century theatres that are in the centre of town, or are you talking about?
Oh, hang on. I'm just thinking about that. Well, the older 19th century theatres are interesting, but in terms of the performing arts centres, so I suppose the ones from the mid-century, what are the kind of challenges that they're seeing in terms of both audience and design?
From a design point of view, the challenges are exactly what Katia pointed out. In many instances, they're sort of peripheral to the heart of a city. And then there are just the issues around their what would you call it? Sort of singularity of their use. So generally, if they're proscenium theatres, then that's all they can be used for. They can't be used for other things. Now, funding, that goes into a funding area. When we were doing Hamer Hall, it was interesting that Tim Jacobs, when he was taking us around, was saying that if you built a Hamer Hall today, you would treble the amount of non-theatre spaces, that is foyers, food and beverage, all of those sorts of things, because that's where their funding, that underpins their funding. So the theatres that are older, that are 60 years old or 70 years old, they struggle from the fact that they have no capacity to increase their revenue because they're inflexible and they don't have enough public facility to embrace that. Yeah. Mm.
And what are they struggling with from an audience perspective, Katia?
Well, I just wanted to add something else to that because there's a sort of a third category of art centres that we haven't talked about. Which is that in Australian towns and cities where perhaps the beneficiary of a lot of very solidly built Victorian public buildings, where for which the purpose that they were originally constructed no longer accommodates the purpose today, and so banks, schools are good examples of that. And because they tend to be what we now think of as heritage buildings, you know, very significant, very beautiful, frankly quite difficult to take apart, you know, they've been repurposed. And in many of the minds of, town planners and things like that, the idea that a heritage building and the arts go together sort of seems to be quite a natural fit. But actually they come with their own set of problems. I mean, just as some examples, you know, the Eternity Playhouse in Darlinghurst, the Yarraville substation in Melbourne, and here in Perth, for instance, we've got the Midlands Art Centre, which was an old Victorian school. So these are all kind of repurposed buildings, and the issues that they come with are around retrofitting a building that was constructed for one purpose for quite a different one, as well as the fact that, you know, Victorian buildings can often... they're quite an imposing style. So for people who are sort of feeling a little bit ambivalent about an arts experience because it's from a culture that maybe they're not familiar with, to come into a building that is can frankly look, you know, like an old bank does, you know, can be a little bit off-putting. So so that's another sort of category of art centre that I just wanted to mention.
Mm. And I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because they've both got issues with being welcoming, but in different ways in terms of design. Maybe just to circle back though to the audiences, in terms of, I suppose, like what does a contemporary performing arts audience look like? And are there challenges, are art centres and arts organisations finding challenges to kind of reaching broader audiences? How are they dealing with it? How are they looking at it?
Yeah, well, I mean, to think about that, it's probably good just to take a step back and think about the way that many public performing arts centres come about. And often it takes a community years, maybe decades of advocacy and campaigning to have an art centre constructed. And in that time, you know, the emphasis increasingly goes on to the need for this thing, whereas the community that originally put the vast number of kind of needs into that campaign gradually kind of falls away, and there's a sort of a core group of campaigners, if you like. And those people do tend to be people who have a pre-existing interest in the performing arts. Then often what happens is that this cause is taken on board by a politician who sees that there's some political merit for them in having an arts centre constructed. And then it becomes all about the building. And the building, you know, it's about the sort of state of the art, the grandeur, the, you know, it's everything that a politician and the media love, you know, real kind of opportunity to have your photo taken on a building site and then, you know, in front of a grand performing arts centre. So what I'm saying is that in the course of that campaign and at the establishment of the arts centre, it's very easy for them to lose connections with the local community that's initially started the campaign. And in that time, of course, as well, the community changes. You know, Australia is a country that experiences significant demographic change just because of our migration patterns. And so you will often have a community that was established, say, with a very, white British or European community initially. Gradually that changes and you have many more people from a vast range of countries where there is quite a different understanding about the way that what signals the arts and what the arts involve, and so that they might be come from cultures where it's much more likely that you perform arts out in the public in the streets or in people's backyards than in dedicated centres. So in the meantime, the Arts Centre has not been able to adapt and accommodate those people, particularly because, as Ian says, they're often built around a kind of a fixed notion of what the performing arts is rather than with the capacity to change and adapt to the communities that they're representing.
Mm. And I think it's quite interesting. I was at a talk recently and they were talking about audience as well, like we're doing here, but they were saying that the way we buy tickets has changed. You used to buy a season ticket for a series of shows, for the ballet or a set of plays or the opera. I don't know. I'm not very good with opera, I must admit. And now we buy single tickets. We don't necessarily have people to go with anymore. People have busy lives. The people who do buy tickets are, you know, of an older demographic or a, you know, and so we need to actually maybe look to reach broader demographics. We need to look to reach younger audiences, more diverse audiences. I mean, some of the communities that you mentioned. I think when you were talking about politicians before, a little thought ran through my head, Ian, that that maybe we're the problem as architects building these big grand things. But I think there's definitely some different ways to look at them. And I know that you've been working on things like that. What are some of the key moves that can be made to make a performing arts centre feel more welcoming?
I think that that issue about the change in the demographic and the even cultural change over the life of a project. I mean, the Geelong Arts Centre, which we just finished last year, I think the original master plan for that was done, and the original concept for a revamping of Geelong Performing Arts Centre as it was in 2003. So it's 20 years. It's taken actually 20 years to get to the point that it's just opened last year. So it almost impossible to predict dramatic changes would happen in that. When Hamer Hall was built, nobody had mobile phones. You know, like it was hardly anyone lived in the city. So those dramatic changes, what can be done to the architectural fabric and the typology of the performing space to make sure that there's scope for it to be more open? I guess what we've been trying to do is to read the tea leaves, so to speak, and see what is happening, and therefore the spaces are, fundamentally, they just have to be more flexible. They have to be like a lot more flexible, which can be more, mean the spaces can be more expensive, or just that they've got a raw base to them that can be added to, fixed up, set up differently, that sort of thing. One of the things that really struck me when we were just starting Geelong, and I'm sort of a bit embarrassed that I didn't think of this earlier, is that it's amazing how found spaces work for festivals. Performing arts festivals, whether it's, you know, the Adelaide Arts Festival or Rising or Sydney Festival, a whole lot of shows are put on in found spaces. And interestingly, the audiences respond to those better than maybe a traditional black box or something like that. And the thing that is some sort of authenticity to a performance that is in an old shed that's being kitted out, particularly a sort of avant-garde or a younger audience orientation, than it is to go into the grand hall of the State Theatre. So to try and find a path through which the spaces are capture that sense of them being found, I sometimes think that it's because a lot of theatre spaces are designed to make the audience subservient to the performance and the technology of the performance, rather than the other way around, rather than the audience be the centre. And there, so for instance, an older theatre that's like the inside of the Forum or a similar one in Sydney, they are amazing spaces. They are I don't care if there's no show on, just go in and have a look at the figurines.
And that's actually got some really, I think it's some really great resonance with some of the research that you've done, Catcher, around kind of putting the audience at the centre of the project. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, so the key there is really to have the audience in mind throughout the whole organisation and right at the beginning of the process. And so, yes, I mean, you know, really every decision that needs to be made, I think every major decision that needs to be made in terms of the location, type, construction, and programming of and maintenance of an art centre needs to have representation from the audiences that you're trying to attract in that decision-making process, because only then really do you see what will work for that community. So I think that's you know, absolutely key, to make sure that representation is genuine. So it's not just, you know, okay, who you know, where are the arts lovers out there that could be part of our board, but actually, you know, where are the people who don't see themselves as arts lovers, you know, who might feel intimidated by the kind of, you know, the ideas of the buildings that we've seen in the past, you know, really kind of drawing on the community in all of the major decision making that goes on in relation to an arts centre.
That feels like a complete shift in thinking. Is that kind of a cultural shift that needs to happen, do you think, in some places?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty challenging. I mean, Ian talks about, you know, a kind of a sense that in the past art centres have been based on the subservience of the audience. And we do demand a lot of audiences traditionally, you know, the sort of buy your tickets in advance, preferably subscribe, you know, turn up on time, preferably, in advance so that you can be fully seated, be quiet, know when to clap. You know, don't disturb the, you know, it's actually, it, you know, if you think about it like that, it begins to sound less like pleasure and more like work. So, you know, really kind of thinking about the way that, you know, audiences across the range, you know, across the life cycle, from small children, you know, families to elderly people, in the way that they wish to attend, and also across the different cultures that, you know, the community represents is key.
So the Geelong Arts Centre has been open for a couple of years now. And what are the really successful spaces there?
Only opened last year, the new bit.
Okay, one. But, you know, surely that's enough to...
The key spaces there is it's got the old theatre, which is from the 1940s. It's embedded in the It was embedded in the 1970s building. But we built two new performance spaces, a 250-seat... what would I call it, sort of a high-tech shed or high-tech hall, and the other one's a 550-seat theatre, which can be set up as a proscenium theatre, traditional proscenium theatre, but on the other hand, it can be a mosh pit With,
oh,
with,
can it?
Yeah, yeah. It can pull all the seats back and actually make the floor dead flat, and it's amazing. So those spaces, the 550 seats, been very successful because it taps into exactly the sort of shows that the commercial theatre people run, so that it can pick up on touring shows. But it's also successful because it can do these other things. And the 250 seat theatre is openable to the outside, so the whole wall can open up. You can walk in off the street, and that's been used for a market. It's used for just gatherings. It's been used for a little one-person performance music show. And so that's just it's interesting. It's just finding its feet because it doesn't tap into that tradition. And so the organisational infrastructure that feeds art centres hasn't quite worked out. How do we make this work? Geelong Arts Centre themselves have worked out that the community want to use it, and so that's been used for these other types of things. And that was our response to Cartier's paper on this idea about if you can make the spaces so that the community use them for all sorts of things, including informally or just pop in or whatever, then the community gradually identify the building as theirs, not as the church where you go to have a lesson. It actually becomes their space.
And in terms of the organisation running it, you're not really, I suppose, you're not presenting things to other people. You're actually facilitating community events, yes, and organisations, yeah, and it's quite beautiful. That's a fantastic space. I've seen that with the doors open up.
Yeah.
I think I was down there and there were school kids on the piano in there, quite small and intimate, although it feels like you could also fit a lot of people in there. That relation to the street.
Yeah.
I think is really critical with that one.
Yeah, the performing arts centres aren't just the theatres. They're all the other spaces as well that are the foyers and the sort of little rooms that are used. And then obviously there's the ubiquitous cafe and how the cafe works. At Geelong we put it right on the street. And it operates just as a traditional street cafe, and you walk through the edge of the cafe to go into the foyer and the theatres, so that there isn't a big empty foyer that when there's nothing on it's there's no one in there. It presents to the street as a place you can occupy and you can just pop into. So that's response to Katia's paper, the idea that they're permeable, visible. And you can just go in without feeling as though I have to buy a ticket for anything.
Mm. These kind of spaces that aren't the spaces we traditionally think of, or first when we think of it, an art centre, that, you know, that aren't the theatre spaces, that are those kind of social spaces or third spaces. Katia, is there anything in your research that talks to, you know, how successful or not successful, how these spaces might be used, their value?
Yes, I mean, Ian's quite right that there's a lot of advantage to the community in being able to encounter a public building incrementally. So if you can, if you have the opportunity to sit outside the building, you know, there's a nice kind of landscaped garden. And then, yes, the foyers are often critical. There was a fantastic chapter in a book recently that talked about the foyer at the Barbican, and particularly about the, you know, what the provision of free Wi-Fi and kind of more, I suppose, comfortable, relaxed spaces attracting not people who were there to necessarily see the shows that were on in the Barbican, but people who needed some indoor space, public space, ranging from families to rough sleepers, all kinds of things, you know, so really kind of attracting the community into the centre itself. And then from there, there may be or maybe not a gradual journey into the arts experiences that are programmed. I also just wanted to kind of say, I think it's really important to continue to see the importance of the performing arts centres, because particularly in many regional towns, the centre is the largest public indoor space. It has the largest capacity to, you know, house the community. So I think, you know, while we might kind of look back on that period of post-war reconstruction as being perhaps idealistic and fed by a narrow sort of set of views, It is true that, you know, if you want to bring your, you know, your whole community together, the Arts Centre is really kind of playing a critical role in that. We just have to get the design right.
Absolutely. I think that's an incredibly important point to make, because we need to tell our stories too. We need to tell local stories as well as bring in, you know, things that are different and unusual. I think it's incredibly interesting.
Picking up on that, Kaji's point about it being a sort of centre of a gathering, that is another. It's interesting in projects where we're just looking at early phases or early feasibilities for regional art centres, that in the Wagga Wagga project, a key part of that was to actually introduce a place for events. So increasingly, another aspect to a performing arts centre is spaces that they can use for the football club dinner and those sorts of things. And so that's the old town hall role, that to some extent the constraints of post-war performing arts centres really didn't allow for. But as we get to spaces which are more and more flexible and less and less black boxy, these are the spaces where communities have a whole lot of other things happening there and gather, and then that allows that sort of sense of ownership and embrace by the community.
And there's different ways we can facilitate and build community. And I think obviously creating a space where community can gather is one, but I just wanted to kind of circle back to a comment that Kaji made a little bit earlier around an incremental experience. This idea is really fascinating to me, that we can slowly build a connection to place. Like, we talk a lot about building connection to place, but it's not about just building something and everybody will come and we'll immediately have community. It's actually about investing the time and effort and inviting people back again and again in different ways. I just find that quite incredible.
I mean, there's both the incremental, which is the first time, what's it called? Threshold fear? To overcome that so that people feel comfortable to be there. I think there's also an aspect to the art centres where they can attract that thing that we were talking before about participatory work. So it isn't just a presentation, it's also making work, it's also the garage being able to use it, which goes to ease of use and cost of use. And those sorts of things are quite difficult. Well, they're becoming more difficult in the current climate. So that the community can feel that the formality of using them is much more casual and easy than highly structured and a whole lot of hurdles put in the use.
Just going to say, there's a really good kind of comparison with libraries to be made here, because, you know, in the past, libraries have put so much emphasis on the value of books that I think probably for the users of the libraries, it was very easy to feel intimidated by that sort of status of the book. So you had to be very careful with the books, et cetera. And it was similar. I think there's a sort of a similar risk for art centres in that if the equipment, the facade, the fit out of the art centre is seen to be the valuable thing, then it's easy to kind of try and control the way that is used, and in a way that is really off-putting for people who want to use it. And so getting that balance right, so you're inviting the community to genuinely come in and use these opportunities rather than putting them off with too much paperwork, you know, red tape, control over the way that things are used. You know, that's the secret. Mm-hmm.
Because these things can be really high tech, can't they, Ian?
Super high tech. Yeah, no, they are. I mean, contemporary. To make a good flexible space now, the technology in it is really complicated. On the other hand, you can actually make it, even though you spend all that money, you can make it quite simple to use. But there is a tendency not to do that. Exactly for that point about we've got to make sure it's safe and it, you know, doesn't get broken. It is a constant challenge in the design of performing arts centres, because a lot of emphasis, the people who are the day-to-day advisors through the design and construction process are the people who run the theatres, and so they want their lives to be as easy as possible. And so the emphasis is on making everything super high-tech and in the realm of where they are. And so it's it it is quite a task for the architects to make sure that that is not the case, that in fact the real client, if that's the term, is the audience and the community, not the guy who's running the lighting grid. Yeah.
And working successfully with community actually just takes time.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? And it takes a different kind of expertise, I suppose, if you think about it. It's a kind of a shift in thinking around the role of the organisation. Katura, is there any kind of interesting successful examples of an arts organisation broadening its demographic and becoming more welcoming and all of those wonderful things?
Yes, I mean, I think a lot of art centres are going through that process at the moment. I suppose one that sort of stands out for me, and it does have a lot of, I will say it has kind of natural attributes, the Footscray Community Arts Centre. I think the way that they've softened the kind of experience or the entrance into the art centre, you know, you go there and there's the lawn out the front with bean bags and, you know, toys for kids and things like that is really a wonderful way of, you know, saying, you know, come on, this is your common space, you feel free to use it how you like, you know, and then feel free to enter the building. I mean, when I say it has natural attributes, it is sort of sitting there on the Yarra and has kind of a lovely outdoor space. Not all art centres kind of, and it's very close to, you know, the sort of walking strip and the train station and things like that. So it is naturally very accessible anyway. But I would kind of hold that up as a good example of a fairly modest, you know, inexpensive, modest ways of trying to make sure that it feels like the community owns the place.
Mm. And then in terms of programming, what can an art centre do to kind of diversify its programming?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I really feel that that sort of power and responsibility needs to be handed over to the community. So so when the programming decisions are made, whether it's in the form of a board or an advisory group or an advisory committee, you know, having community input into the programming is critical. And as I said, I think, you know, that idea about what the community is not kind of gathering into the room all of the people who are the sort of declared arts lovers. It's actually going out and finding the kind of key, you know, influences in particular parts of the community, whether that might be, you know, young people and people from a variety of different cultural and ethnic groups, you know, to come in and find a way for them to give advice about the program is really critical. Having said that, I mean, you know, one of the other things that makes it difficult for an art centre is there's a lot of emphasis on the establishment and construction of a building, and unfortunately much less on providing arts funding that maintains the programming and maintains the building. And this is a kind of a common, really undesirable pattern. And so often art centres do find that they're in a sort of a difficult situation where they become a hall for hire, a venue for hire, in order to try and make up the sort of lack of funding that they receive for programming. That can often work really well because it does invite the people that are hiring the venue, you know, who may not, as I say, be arts lovers, but be from quite different cohorts in the community. But at worst, it's just a hall for hire, and then it might as well just be a commercial building.
Mm. I think funding is an interesting thing in this space. You kind of mentioned funding, and often in the arts, coming from a kind of a cultural organisation that sometimes applies for arts grants, there's often funding for content, but there's not really funding for operations, and that engagement with community is, I suppose, that operational level. Which is really critical. How would you fund art centres differently, Ian?
Oh, I think that Katia's point is spot on, and it's interesting that the great architectural icon of Frank Gehry's Guggenheim in Bilbao, everyone concentrates on the building and says, wasn't that amazing thing? And it was the funding that was a joint thing between the government and the Guggenheim Foundation. But the government also gave some millions, I can't remember what it was, it could have been 20 million or something like that, to the local communities, art communities that were already there, to produce new works. And that was over years. So one of the reasons for the success of that building in the city was because of the art community got all this longer-term funding to put to produce new works. And you just think, well, that sort of idea about a balance between the bricks and mortar and the actual content and the operational side of it, so that the works, particularly emerging or fringe arts groups, is absolutely crucial to the success of regional arts centres, I think, and all arts centres. So that idea that the community are funded or supported is probably a better way to put it, to actually exploit the demand for doing work and creating work, is as fundamental as it is to the new edifice. And when you think about the number of dance schools that there are, whether it's the six-year-old Taparama or it's students who are wanting to do hip-hop or that sort of thing, it's a huge demand. And likewise with kids who want to play music, make music, it's a huge demand. So the dance schools are all in little, halls that they can afford and that sort of thing. That's a part of that thing that a community demands of an arts centre, that they have access to that. Now, in many instances, they have their iSteadfords and their final shows there, which is fantastic. But they could be used more, and I think that's because with better fund structuring the funding of, and almost like having a crossover, some sort of idea about more crossover between the two. Planning that better would be a great advance in bringing the arts into each community, or enhancing the arts in each community.
Mm. I mean, we often think of the life of the city in terms of the life on the street. So maybe we think about the art centre as the life of the art centre in terms of like the life of the community inside it, like how much we can get, like the little and the small, the fine grain, through it, as well as the large stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about the performances that go around through street festivals and things like that, that's a similar sort of sense of, or a foundation experience that the art centres can open up to, and I think that needs to be embraced more.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that, if you've had the opportunity to dance in the, major art centre in your town when you're 6 years old, you'll be much more likely to come back to it when you're 30 and, interested in some entertainment for the night. So, really kind of starting that relationship in ways that communities feel comfortable with, is critical to the ongoing, sense of connection.
Last year, the Recital Centre was on the Open House Melbourne program, and I think they had, you could get up on the stage for 15 minutes all by yourself. They cleared the theatre and you could do anything except for tap dance on the stage, because apparently, I don't know, Ian, maybe the floors needed to be harder or something.
Well, tap shoes are pretty hard.
Yeah, tap shoes. fair call. But anyway, I just thought that was a really beautiful way. Like, you didn't have to sing, you could do whatever. They did, I think, go through a bit of an interview process with people to make sure nothing extraordinarily strange was going to happen. But I just thought that was a beautiful way to get people engaged. Sing like nobody's watching, is that, or is it dance? Yeah. Whatever it is. But I thought that was just gorgeous.
That was hugely popular. And the word of mouth on it was fantastic, with people who said, I went and sang.
Great. Just moments to engage people. I think it's just beautiful. Well, we're almost coming to the end of the conversation, I think. It's been a really wonderful conversation, and it's left me with a lot of food for thought. And next time I go into an arts centre, I'm going to be looking at all their foyer spaces and their theatres and all the different bits and pieces. But I think just to wrap up a little bit, I'm interested in, if we're thinking about the arts as an element around which we build community, what do our future art centres look like in an ideal world? Katya, do you have a perfect version of an art centre, or one of many maybe, I don't know?
Well, I do have sort of four suggestions, and they, by this stage in the conversation, you will have, you'll perhaps be able to preempt them. The first one is around making sure that the entrance to the building is very porous. And so Ian's example of the being able to shift the wall on the 250-seat theatre so that it can actually become outdoor space, can accommodate a market, it's that real kind of making sure that the space between the outside world and the centre itself is movable. That's very critical, I think. So that's the first one. And the second one is overall to pay a good deal of attention to the intermediate spaces. So, you know, okay, you've got your proscenium arts theatre or your black box, you know, that's one thing, but equally important the garden outside, the foyer, the entranceway, any kind of intermediate space that people use in addition to that when they're sort of sitting and watching, if you like, because, you know, they're often the ways that we encounter public art centres first. And the third one is that, you know, the future art centre is genuinely managed by its local community. So making sure that, and this is less about the way that the centre looks physically, and it's more making sure that, the whole kind of everyone across the range in the community has input into how it's run, what's programmed, you know, what goes on there. I think that's really important. And then the fourth one, which is more a kind of a perhaps the local council government factor, is to make sure that you're reducing the red, although it can be the building as well, make sure that you're reducing the red tape involved in using it. So make sure that the requirements that you have of people who want to use it are not such that they are put off by it. You know, make sure that there's the opportunity to have signage outside, for example. That signage tends to be a big one where, you know, councils have a great deal of many rules, but make sure that however it's going to, the community wants to use the centre is possible, I suppose, within the bounds of safety and cost and things like that. But just have that as your kind of key principle, that this is for the use of the community first. So those are my four.
I think they're great points to think about. Ian?
Well, four is a good number. I've quickly had to write down my four. I think I mentioned flexibility, that can the future of performing arts centres is in their ability to be able to use for things that we know now are the widest possible variety, and also things that we might not have even thought of in the future. So I think it is actually about, from a designer's point of view, in remembering to focus on the audience, to make it audience centred, from an experience point of view, and that really goes to that they're easy to go to, they're easy to use, they're easy to be in, that sort of thing. There, and they enhance that excitement and the joy of actually performance. I think the other thing that we haven't really touched on is this idea that any performing arts centre exists in a place. And that place has a character, and it has a narrative of its history, it has stories. And so we would always argue that the architecture should somehow capture that. And obviously modern architecture, contemporary architecture, which is kind of a kit of parts, or doesn't do that. So the architect should work to create a sense of the atmosphere of a place that is, and in Geelong we did this, in Wagga we've been doing this, and it's actually about the notion of what is Geelong. It's got an amazing history with the Wadawurrung, a continuous history, and then settler history, and then contemporary stories that it tells about its own identity. That needs to be captured and exposed in the architecture, so that the community also can go along and say, oh, I know what that's about. Oh, that's about. So there's a sense of belonging of the building through the narratives of the local community, and therefore it's actually a building about that place. Mm-hmm. It's not a universalised. It's about an experience of being in the place you live.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's another whole podcast in that way. We'll have to have you back. Cool. Lovely. I'd love to thank you both. That was such an interesting conversation. It's given me much food for thought. Thank you, Katja and Ian.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you for listening to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast. Open House Melbourne delivers Australia's largest architecture and built environment festival, and year-round programming that connects people to place and builds public understanding of good design, inspiring people to explore, celebrate and care for their cities, suburbs and regions. Open House Melbourne's Catalyst podcast series was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. This series is recorded at The Push in Collingwood Yard, a youth music organisation and charity with the purpose of giving every young person the opportunity to participate and thrive in Australian music.
Find out more about The Push at thepush.com.au.